Welcome to a special StarTrek.com audio commentary for Star Trek The Motion Picture, the Director's Edition. Today we are joined by three people whose extraordinary work on the Director's Edition effectively realized director Robert Wise's original vision of the film, producer David C. Fine, restoration supervisor Michael Matesino, and visual effects supervisor Darren R. Doctorman. Start playing the DVD now.
Hello and welcome to our commentary. My name is Mike Matesino. I was the restoration supervisor for the director's edition of Star Trek The Motion Picture, the director in question being Mr. Robert Wise, our dear friend, colleague, and mentor, who left us in September of 2005, shortly after his 91st birthday. May he rest in peace.
Indeed.
I am joined today by the two other gentlemen, without whom this project would not have been possible, and I'll let them introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Dave Fine. I'm the producer of this little film, Star Trek The Motion Picture, the Director's Edition. I'm here with my good friends, and I'm sure Mr. Wise and Bob in spirit.
And this is Darren Doctorman, and I was the visual effects supervisor for this film. And I don't need to say the title of it again, because I think everyone knows what it is because they're watching it.
You think by now?
And I just wanted to say that we are from Television City in Hollywood. We are live on tape.
Yeah, so without further ado, we...
On tape? What's tape?
Yeah, what is tape? And we'd like to thank our friends here at CBS who
Indeed.
Are on the other side of the glass recording this as we watch this terrific film. And we're listening to the marvelous musical overture by Jerry Goldsmith, who also left us in 2004. But he worked with us on this project. And it brings several things to mind. The first of which is that I think his only other musical overture, which was quite common in the 50s and 60s during the so-called Roadshow era, his only other one was on Bob Wise's film The Sand Pebbles, released in 1966. And I think, and my friends can correct me if I'm wrong, I think this film and Disney's The Black Hole, which opened 1 week later, were probably the last two films to theatrically open with this musical prelude.
I think that's right.
It was Black Hole at the time.
And it was a way of really, you know, stating that this was a big, important film. And there was a lot of publicity about Star Trek when it opened in December of 1979. The other thing that I'm reminded of is the sort of Robert Wise tradition of having something on screen while the overture plays, as opposed to a traditional black leader. Because I think at the time West Side Story was done in 1961, there was a lot of word going around that theaters were cropping the overture off because they thought it was leader.
And a lot of the prints that that we viewed had the overture chopped off as well, we noticed.
That's right.
It was great that Bob took the time to, you know, suggested that we do a star field. Mm-hmm. And it always felt like we were talking about it being either V'ja's journey or the Enterprise's journey back.
And we were going backwards, so we're sort of like that cliche of to see where you've been. This was the relaunch of Star Trek as a franchise for Paramount in 1979. After many years of development and the cancellation of the original television series 10 years earlier. And now we come to the credits, and boy, this just brings back a lot of things, too. Because one of you guys walked in one day with a fantastic objet d'art that I'll never forget. Which one of you was it?
Which one are you talking about?
Some black cards with white letters.
Oh, God.
Oh, yes.
The original titles
the original
when they were
title cards.
And the Woody Allen version.
Right. The black and white that they shot as
temps.
Yeah, so, as temps, and just had to cut it into the movie.
So there was some verisimilitude here because we used those actual things. We didn't just type this on a computer. We actually scanned those original title cards,
mm-hmm.
Correct?
That's correct.
And I don't know about you guys, but I'm remembering going to see this as a kid, and we knew, it was highly publicized that this film was extraordinarily expensive, over $40 million. We didn't know then that a good chunk of that had been spent on development. But mm-hmm. When you went to see this film and you saw those simple credits, you wondered, this does not feel like a big budget film, mainly because I remember that just a year before this opened, we had Superman, which was another hugely budgeted film. They don't even know how much it cost. And that had those spectacular animated credits, and you knew that the money was on the screen.
Well, I just remember when I first saw it that it didn't even occur to me that those were temp credits. I thought that was exactly what they meant to do, and that it was the way they wanted it. And
it was
after realizing it, I the first thing that I did on this project was actually re-render the main title logo and make it the one that appears now.
And I think we found storyboards of different versions of for the titles when they were in the planning stages for this movie, and a lot of them, some of them were more elaborate than what we ultimately went with. And I think we Bob agreed that we should try to not stray too far from what the movie was, but to fix what needed to be fixing. And we'll talk more about how that whole process evolved. But with specific regard to the credits, I do remember one other very funny story where we debated the color of them.
Well, there was a lot of talk about how the film was considered very cold in general, and there was some talk about going from the white logo, the white credits, to a blue, almost reminiscent of season 3 of the classic show.
Mm-hmm. And because most of this movie is lit blue, not this particular scene with the Klingon cruiser, but later on, everything associated with V'ger seems to be blue. The uniforms are very pale blue. Mm-hmm. And so it seemed consistent.
So it's funny that we actually brought, you know, Bob came in that day and we were saying, okay, well, here's the credits in blue, and we were showing him the whole thing, and he was saying, well, what other options do we have? And it's nice that inverting blue gives a goldish color, so it's pretty simple for us to just invert the coloring scheme. And he really liked the gold look to it, and that kind of gave us a whole feeling of, in general, we wanted to stick to this gold motif for this version of the film. And I think his exact words was let's go with the gold. It has balls.
At which point we all hit the floor.
Yeah, because, like, I mean, Bob?
Bob was an incredible gentleman and worked in this industry for 60 years and never ceased to be a gentleman, which is why he was a mentor and an inspiration to so many people. And to suddenly hear him just come out and say that, which was absolutely true. You know, and in retrospect, as I look at it, he was absolutely right. And he knew his stuff. And
it touches me that one little decision that he made, and he said it so strongly, gave us the, you know, the gold packaging, the gold logo is just gorgeous, and it just stuck to the project. And it was a very big conscious decision when we started with the project, was to warm the whole thing up with all the mechanical voices and, you know, the whole coldness of the film left, you know, people with that feeling as well. And just the premise of going with the gold and having it be warm from the beginning helped dramatically.
And even the color timing, which we participated in near the beginning of the project, was focused on making everything less gray than mm-hmm. it had appeared in previous transfers.
And that was mainly the transfers, because mm-hmm. the film didn't look like that.
No, the film was actually quite warm.
And one of the first things we did was get a print from Paramount, took it to the Directors Guild, and screened it, and we were all shocked, really, about how great it looked and how we'd been looking cable TV and VHS versions for many, many years, and it just belied what the film truly looked like.
And unfortunately, even that print was missing the overture.
Yes.
That some projectionist, you know, had thought, what's all this extra leader at the beginning of the film?
And we had another wonderful guy, Richard Klein, the director of photography on this, who'd also worked with Bob on the Andromeda Strain, participating in this and working with us and making it look the way that it should. And just so many things come back as we watch this.
Yeah, I remember a considerable amount of, you know, there was some flaws in some of the shots, like the little the
floating
guy in the
little
space
blue,
suit and
the little blue dot,
that was in the Klingon shot that we had to paint out shot frame by frame.
We should maybe say as quickly as possible, but, you know, just to summarize for anybody who might not know, is that really what was released in 1979, as far as Bob Wise was concerned, was a first rough cut of the picture. They were locked into a release date. It was an extraordinary number of challenges meeting that date. And somebody said that even if it had to have black leader in it, it had to go out on that date.
That was Michael Eisner, and it was even in his book.
He was head of Paramount at the time.
That if the film was had black leader, it was going to go out as it was. It was also funny that Richard Klein had mentioned to us that everyone seemed really uncomfortable about the original release of the film because how rushed it was, that there was a funny story they once told us that they took out the largest stage at MGM when they were printing the film, and they had the film cans lined up in a row, and he remembered walking in there, and he got this sinking feeling like it was like the little tombstones.
Right. Well, reel one would come in, they'd drop it in the cans. Right. Reel two would come in. When they had a full set of cans, it went on to a plane and off to the theater.
So here comes the real star of this director's edition, the planet Vulcan.
One of the major stars.
There is so much to talk about, because what Dave was mentioning about the coldness of the film and trying to warm it up. Part of the rush of this production was that what really could have been a fantastic sci-fi classic is actually in this film. You just have to look a little bit harder to find it. And
gorgeous work by Foundation.
I just want to say that the, Dave Morton, who did the matte paintings for these, did an absolutely spectacular job, and I think it really gives us the feeling of Vulcan, and it relates to every other Vulcan that we've seen.
Did the did anybody ever mention that about the digital Spock there?
Sure.
I think that was covered.
That was in the doc.
It was covered. I think that was in the documentary. Yeah,
it was a documentary on the special effects for the director's edition.
But what other people don't know is that these shots as well have a little changes to them.
On the left side of the boot.
On the left side of the boot, there was some kind of underground, it looked like a refinery or something.
Actually, think of what it was the docking port for the Vulcan shuttle we see later.
Ah.
It's really
and,
small
you know,
planet.
Now this, I mean, it was, which Yurisich did the matte paintings for this?
It was Matt.
Matthew,
yeah.
And he actually started working on one that looked like what we all ended up with on that establishing shot, which combined painting with a plate, a forced perspective plate done at Yellowstone.
Right.
And they ended up scrapping that and going for this crazy thing with moons in the sky and this shuttle port there. And, you know, it somehow didn't feel that it would work to know that if you went for this monastic purging that Spock is going through, that you could just say, well, this isn't working out for me. You know, you wanted to imagine that he had to walk across the desert for days and go without food, and it really needed to be desolate.
And let me just mention something quickly here about this, the layout of this Vulcan temple. As you notice on the floor, the tiles are basically set in a six-sided pattern. And on the necklace that she gives Spock, there's also a six-sided figure on there. And V'ger itself is a six-sided object. So we began to realize that this six-sided object could theoretically represent total logic itself. And so we set out in the backstory and figuring out what this Vulcan temple would look like. We made a giant six-sided plateau with one of these statues at each of the pinnacles of it. And so it actually does make sense in the overall scope of the design of the movie.
Yet all based on the storyboards that they actually originally done. That they really didn't get to accomplish the way they had been initially designed.
And I was really happy that we saw later on Enterprise they used this to the same temple design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely kept consistent with everything else.
San Francisco.
Now, who shot the plate for this, Darren?
This was one of our friends who actually was a co-creator of Lightwave. And his name is Alan Hastings, and he shot the plates for these up in San Francisco.
One of the things that was great about the Spock in his outfit, we actually found early proof photos of caveman Spock in a loincloth and a big skin over him on the bridge of the Enterprise. That these were test photos that we found. That was just amazing. But they've never been seen. But it was just, we were looking at this, thinking about what the possibilities were. Had this caveman come out?
There was no doubt about it that the effects work on the film originally was truly spectacular. But if you analyzed it very closely, you saw how, in a lot of instances, they just got by. And I think when we saw the original effects storyboard book, we just were all astounded at really what was designed, what was planned, and what they weren't able to do.
It showed a much more completed vision than we got.
I always thought it was just funny that they built this escalator there. That's not an escalator, but if you look at it, it was just a moving staircase. Darren, you want to say something about how much work was put into that one, the shot of the station, the headquarters?
There was a lot of work, just basically extending it out to, you know, give Mr. Wise more of the vast expanses that he wanted and that was impossible from the plates that they had shot with the tram being in front of this basically big brown wall. And so we figured out a way to extend it out without having to affect the live-action plates.
We should say that the principal effects artists on the film were the great Doug Trumbull, who had just come off of Close Encounters of the Third Kind when he did this, and was very famous for 2001.
Right.
John Dykstra, who had originally been his assistant when they worked on the graphics for Bob's Andromeda Strain. And then John went off and became the visual effects supervisor, won an Oscar for the original Star Wars. And then when they got into a bind with finishing the effects for this, they worked together and basically split them. So this orbital office for the San Francisco Yard was really the introduction of the Doug's entertainment effects group work on the film. Prior to this, we've seen Dykstra's work primarily on the Klingon battle that opened the film, and the paintings, as earlier mentioned by Matt Yurasich.
It was at this time that we were beginning to do the project that we realized we were going to go back and speak to Doug and John, that at the same time we realized if we can get them together and do, not to get them together, but all the people we knew we were going to be speaking to about the history, that we should also record the interviews for them. So we ended up doing all of the interviews for the special features and such, because we were already hunting down the people, and we felt that it was a good way to get our answers, but also have those interviews shared.
They all did look at our work and everything, and they really saw that we were making it all look as if it had been done at the time, or could have been done at the time, and that it would blend seamlessly and actually make their work look better, and just give it that extra notch that we all imagined in our love of Star Trek at the time that was really there. But when we looked at it closely, we saw that there's just small improvements that could be made, small enhancements, without really changing the overall film as an experience. We wanted it to be the film that you really thought you saw when you first went to see it. And the other thing is, I think that we hoped that if somebody had never seen it or never seen any Star Trek, that if they watched this movie, we would pull them in. And Bob always wanted to, you know, attract just the average moviegoer to an entertaining experience. And maybe then you'd go check out other Star Trek and watch the many other films and the shows that exist. This scene, I think when we first started talking about this project and a few trusted friends that we mentioned, this always came up, this scene, because this is became kind of infamous.
If you're a Star Trek fan, you love the view of the Enterprise. If you're, it seems to have been, if you're a member of the public who wasn't a huge Star Trek fan, you'd wonder why we're spending all this time going around the ship.
And they expected that this would be the first thing that we cut out.
Or cut down considerably.
I don't think we ever for a moment considered cutting it down. There are several forces at work in this amazing scene. One of them is Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, because here in this 5 or 6 minute sequence, it's everything that he believed in, this possibility that if we just sort of get over ourselves, we could actually have this. We could actually be going up and there is a spaceship ready to go to other star systems, travel, meet other life forms, you know, and that we could actually get to that point with just a little bit of work. And then the other force you have is Doug Trumbull with his concept of first-person cinema, where you set up the narrative and then you back the characters out of it so that you as an audience member are the character in the movie. You are in this travel pod experiencing this, looking at this incredible vessel ready for launch. And the other thing is that Trumbull pulls it off in a very realistic way. You notice you could linger on these shots much, much longer than almost any shot is held in a film made nowadays, effects or otherwise. You know, you really buy the image. And of course, then the other, in my opinion, the other force at work here is Jerry Goldsmith, who wrote this 5 minute, 58 second cue called The Enterprise that you just cannot take one note out of. It's absolutely perfect. The dialogue goes away, and it becomes what movie making is all about. That combination of image sound that creates emotion, and you don't need anything else in the way. You can't touch it.
One change we did make in this sequence is coming up, and it's a subtle thing, but it really connects to the humanity of the story by, funny enough, showing the Enterprise in a shot that we hadn't seen it before. And that is the shot of Captain Kirk looking out the front view screen, and we see the reflection of his love on the outside of the pod. There it is.
Mm-hmm. It really went from a simple close-up to an image that, to me, encapsulates all of Star Trek in that one image. And that was directly inspired by Doug Trumbull, who wanted to really do that throughout the sequence. But again, just they had a phrase that was going around their effects facility at the time they were making this, which was crop it, flop it, or drop it. They had to take the path of least resistance in a lot of this work to just get a sequence together that made sense. And I think Jerry really saved a lot of that with this, what to me is the greatest score that he's ever made, that he's ever composed, and one of the greatest scores in the history of film music.
I always felt that this sequence was also a gift to all of the people who dreamt of going off into space and had their Enterprise models, and you'd hold up your model and you'd look at it, and this it's like giving you a great representation of being able to go around and look at the new model as this beautiful introduction of the ship where it is today.
And the Enterprise herself has never looked better than mm-hmm. in this sequence.
Well, certainly for Star Trek fans, it just was an amazing thing to go from that, the outdated effects from the late 60s, which is still loved anyway, but to be able to go and see it and hold on it for this length of time and have it really be believable, it just was astounding. And I think that anybody who suggested that this be cut had never seen this on a big screen, where it was meant and where it was designed to be shown. Because when you did look at it in the theater, it was blown away. You never were bored, you never thought of losing a second, you wanted to study every corner of the frame.
Rick Sternbeck, who I got to work with on the pilot of Voyager, tells this story of being called. He worked on Star Trek: The Motion Picture as one of the illustrators, and he was called in one day to teach Scotty how to fly the space pod because they hadn't really given the actors any instruction of what to do or how to look like they're flying this thing. And so Rick went into the stage one morning and sat there and told Scotty how to fly.
Yet we don't see the controls a single time.
Well, nowadays in the future, it's hit a button and it does it. So there's something really to be said about the design of this whole film, that it set a much higher standard than the original show had, that I think really carried on to the subsequent movies and the subsequent shows, that the beautiful aspects of this film, the beautiful designs, even the ship with the glowing engines, etc., helped raise the bar for the show and everything else that was going on subsequently, all the next Generation and Deep Space Nine. And
it did raise the bar, I think, just in general for science fiction filmmaking, and that was going on in other films at the time. This was the year of Alien, the year after Superman, as I mentioned before, and of course Star Wars, Close Encounters, fantastic visionary, timeless classics now.
We were talking about the audio work here. I remember that we were bringing up the elevator sound effect, almost as if the elevator was beckoning him, don't step out into the bridge, was something I remembered having a conversation with Chuck Michael, our sound supervisor for the film. And there was so much work that we were really serious about making sure the sound played a tremendous role in this picture. And I told Chuck at the beginning of the project, you're going to get us the PG rating, which we actually were able to get for the film. And you watch this film, there's nothing that really would say this is going to be a PG rated picture, especially when it was rated before. So the work that Chuck and his group did was just phenomenal in helping that happen. And we'll talk about more of the specifics when those scenes come up.
What you just saw was the first dialogue scene. That little exchange after Kirk left the bridge, little moment that was not in the film when it was originally released in 1979. It was shown on the television versions, but that illustrates this whole idea of focusing on the humanity of the picture. And I mentioned earlier about how this really is a flawed science fiction classic. I think that there was this idea that you were going to redesign the Enterprise. It was going to be state of the art. And so consequently, there would just be this technology overload. The computers spoke and the machines seemed to run everything. The problem was we ultimately get to what they're going after, and they find that V'ger is a machine. So the machines became everything about the story. But instead, I think what needed to happen and what we attempted to do, since we couldn't really change the movie, was to show that on the Enterprise, it was nothing without the people. It had to be what the tagline on the poster said. It had to be a human adventure. And the essential problem in this movie, that maybe if they'd had more time to work on the script, they could have gotten that far, is that this inability of people to work together and to connect to each other is the essential problem. And it mirrors V'ger's problem, his or its feeling of incompleteness and needing to connect with something, which it does physically. And I noticed, and God, Bob hated when I pointed out this kind of symbolism and stuff in his films. He always said he never intended. You're talking about a guy who didn't see the Christ metaphors in the Day of the Ursa still, okay? Mm-hmm. But the shot where the travel pod docks with the Enterprise, that image of things connecting to each other is a motif that goes throughout the film. In the Vulcan scene, you saw Spock refuse the connection. He pushes that necklace away. He doesn't want that connection because he's sensing the calling of something else. And later on, when Spock's shuttle docks, and then it ultimately leads to the trip into V'ger, which, if you think about it also, this movie is about going out into space and exploring. That's what Star Trek is about. But what do we end up with? We end up with a plot that goes inside. We're constantly moving into things. We go into a cloud, we go into a vessel, we go into a chamber in that vessel, and we end up with a little island and a little wire that's not connected. And, you know, the story that's really going on here is about the need for people to connect to each other. And we try to just go further with that. And the way to do that was to focus on the people, get rid of the machines on the Enterprise as much as possible, make it about people.
What I need to comment about here for the scene was that this was one of the pivotal moments that I said to Chuck, this is going to, you know, this is part of our PG rating here. We need nails on the chalkboard, you know, chills down your spine. Imagine, and I remember saying to him, imagine, you know, you're this horrible ball of flesh looking for some way, form of yourself to scream out of. Just try to think of the most nightmarish thing you could think of to, you know, evoke and get that horrible sound. And I believe we really succeeded in accomplishing that frightening moment to make it even more frightening, because as a kid, it terrified me, the scene.
Do you think that moment gave us the PG?
I think that's one of the key moments that gave the PG, the power of the sound throughout the film did it, but that was one of the pivotal moments that did earn us the PG. There was another thing that Bob had mentioned here, and we had the benefit of 20 years of preview screenings of the film being released. And
which was like the preview, because he didn't actually have one.
Right.
The preview was
Bob would have previewed the film. And there's been one of the questions here was Kirk had a line where he would go, "Oh my God." And that line almost always would gather a laugh from anybody who's watching. And here's this very serious sequence that, you know, these characters and these people have just died. And it was a bad laugh, as Bob, you know, as you'd call it. And that's one of the reasons that the line had to be pulled. But it's funny because with so many people being familiar with the film, there's people who have actually come up to us and said, "How could you pull the line? Oh my God, I loved it." And it's just not right for that moment. It's changing the tone away from the film. And that's why we needed to cut that line.
The other thing is that we found out that they shot a lot of incidental dialogue almost as protection, because they knew about the bind of this visual effects and worried that they might not have a coherent story. So if somebody actually came and said what was happening, it might fill in for an effect that didn't get made. So since the transporter effects were there and worked, it was very obvious that you needed that exchange between Shatner and Jimmy Doohan worked fine. And again, now it suddenly wasn't about a transporter malfunction. It was about two people just died.
If you look here at the people that are just standing here watching the view screen, the shortest woman in the front in a tan jumpsuit is actually Millicent Wise, Bob's wife.
Well, we could roll this scene back 40 times and constantly talk about all the people that they put in here. It was like this huge casting call of extras, plus anybody who was anybody in Star Trek at the time. There's another cut that was made in this scene that I've gotten complaints about since we finished this.
Me too.
But I absolutely stand by it, and that's after this image that they're going to look of Epsilon 9 being destroyed or absorbed by V'ger. Admiral Kirk asks his chief communications officer to turn the viewer off. And in the original cut of the film, she freezes, staring either at her commanding officer or at a Federation emblem on the screen. I'm not sure which. But she freezes and has to be told twice to turn the viewer off while 430 crew members are standing there about to go after this thing to find out what it is, where they've just seen other Starfleet officers killed by it. And it just was very clear that, you didn't want to have a command officer. You know, this crew would think, well, if we're in a crisis, is our communications officer going to just freeze and do nothing?
Right. These people have supposedly been out seeing wonders and strange things for at least 5 years.
Yeah.
And they probably have seen things maybe even worse than this. And, they are a good group of people that know what to do, even under pressure.
And if you're working on that bridge, you're not going to freeze.
Look, a space station was destroyed by a cloud.
Which she's probably
I love this scene with this poor guy trying to outrun the the zapper laser rays.
It's a great image.
I can make it. I think I can make it. I'm pretty sure
again, the human element. It becomes not about the effects. Oof. It becomes about somebody dying.
And then he trips and dies.
Boom. Love the jury score.
See, now there's Admiral Kirk standing. We're really with the point of this doing this scene was that you heard on the old TV show about 430 crew people, but you never saw more than maybe 20.
What I love is
here
that
they are. But now here he is, poor Kirk, standing there, have to stare his entire crew in the face. And what do I tell them? And he has to say, well, we're just going to get on with it, people.
There's some guy standing in the front row, Rob Klein, who is a prop expert and one of the people that worked with us on the project. There's a guy in the foreground, you may have to ring this back, that's wearing a white a piece of plastic on his, or a white console on his chest. And I believe it was Rob, who did some great work with us on the collecting materials for this project, who pointed out that that's actually the bottom section of a Cylon Raider model. From
Battlestar
Galactica.
I don't know if the Galactica, Dykstra's Galactica shop had really wrapped up it yet at this point, so they grabbed anything they could. They might have even been some Logan's Run costumes at Starfleet.
Oh, the lovely Persis Kombata.
Straight from George Lucas's THX 1138, including the Oath of Celibacy.
She obviously didn't take her oath very seriously.
A former Miss India, who then died tragically at the age of 50 from a heart attack. So, but from all accounts, she was a lovely person. She was a carryover, actually, from the Star Trek Phase 2, which is how this movie originally began its life, as Paramount's attempt to relaunch Star Trek as a television series with the entire original cast. And
on their own network.
On their own network, which then didn't happen for another 20 years. But when that was aborted and they went for making a feature film, fortuitously in the wake of Star Wars, her character and that actress, as the bald Delton Ilea, was carried over.
And all the costs of developing that series were actually transferred to the budget of this film, and that's one of the reasons why it was very expensive.
What was great was that we did come across footage and lots of test footage and lots of photos from the filming. And there were two interesting things that we discovered from that footage. Number one, two interesting. One thing that was great to observe was the
Before you say that, I just want to say that McCoy is in fact not wearing the headpiece to the Staff of Ra around his neck.
Uh-huh. That's like saying Uhura does not take fast food orders for Burger King.
That's right.
Because that's not a Burger King logo behind her. Right. But
I do think he was beamed up directly from the Playboy Mansion.
He might have been, but if you remember, the one of the things we didn't change was that we didn't add his beard being beamed up. Because the outline of him doesn't have his beard, you know, a little thing that if somebody was nitpicking, they'd make a comment about.
The little moment that was added in, again, it was also in the TV extended version, the yeoman that comes up and gives that little, you know, introductory thing that you know McCoy is coming. Each of the three main characters have a very theatrical entrance in this film, which was a nice touch.
I need you badly.
Again, so you joke about that line, Darren, but it's like, you know, that's the whole theme.
I joke because I love.
Yeah, there's people who need each other. If they're going to go out and do this, if they're going to try to manage this technological, you know, marvel and go out to other planets, other civilizations, you know, they have to connect with each other. And everybody's very disconnected in this film. And I'm realizing that was a theme sort of in some of those movies that I mentioned at the time. Star Wars, you have what Darth Vader calls a technological terror, you know, and he himself is a technological terror. And what defeats it, you know, human beings coming together, people who say, may the force be with you, and have metal ceremonies. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which ended up not being about UFOs, but it was about being chosen, you know, and connecting with another life form. E.T., of course, was the pinnacle of that. That was sort of a theme throughout the science fiction films of this era, and Star Trek is about that just as much as those others.
Mike, do you remember the first time we went to Paramount? It was many, many years ago, and I remember walking past a dumpster, and we saw one of the Enterprise bridge panels,
mm-hmm.
and we just realized by that point that that bridge was never going to be seen again. Mm-hmm. Said that they had scrapped.
That was right after The Undiscovered Country, I believe.
Well, no, it was after Trek 4, because the bridge was still set up for that, and I think what was left over of the bridge might have ended up at Universal for the Star Trek adventure at the time.
Notice the great subtle acting, and I'm being totally serious, the subtle acting by Shatner in this scene, how he's acting really nervous about taking the old girl out again.
Well,
and you can see his little
fingers
are, you know, just nervously tapping his chair.
Isn't this an element of the 48-year-old guy? Of course, we're all far from being 48. The 48-year-old guy who gets a Porsche. Isn't there an element of that in this?
This is Kirk's midlife crisis that he finally reconciles in Star Trek II.
It's funny that I remember Trumbull, this model, this gorgeous, amazing model that we were able to use, bring back for the project to create the CG model for the Enterprise, is about 8 feet tall, 8 feet long. But I remember Trumbull saying that it was just absolutely a brilliant size, but he would have gone even bigger.
Even bigger, can you imagine?
That past shot of the Enterprise coming toward us and coming out of the dry dock was actually a shot that we changed for this project. Because if you'll notice in the original version,
or in Trek Two,
where it's still, you'll notice that the outline of a support rod coming out of the side of the Enterprise is blocking out the dry dock behind it.
I didn't notice it. Oh, you got rid of it.
We got rid of it. That's right.
Now, actually,
for the next film, it was a different time that the Enterprise was launching. That time they needed a support arm. Right.
Coming up here is one of my absolute favorite changes.
Yes,
and I think it illustrates everything that I said before about focusing on the humanity. You're coming to the Enterprise about to fly into the outer reaches of the solar system, and there's an exchanged glance between Ilea and Decker, played by the great Stephen Collins. We also got to go over to Seventh Heaven set, where he just finished 11 seasons on that show. Unbelievable. And we took that from later on, and replaced... what was there, like an Astro Gator?
It was the Astro Gator with lights blinking on and off.
Again, that was a shot of technology. What are we looking at? Why is it important? You know, this is about people going out into space who have relationships with each other, who long for connection with each other. And now we're it's starting those little episode. Changes without really affecting the overall film. It's just little things that they would have done had they previewed this film and saw there's too much of an emphasis on effects and technology, you know, and we need to make some of small changes to kind of even that balance out. Well, and it's a change like that that just helps it, in my estimation, just infinitesimally.
But wasn't the shot of the astrogator also, they did lots of shots of technology and lights going off and things happening just to cover up the possible lack
the
of
possible
visual effect.
Lack of something on the view screen.
Right.
So they had a panel to cut
so
to.
So many different things to cover. I want to go back before I lose track of this to phase two. The thing that we found that was unusual about the phase two footage was this was for a television show, yet they shot it widescreen. And we were wondering where that decision to
that was very interesting.
Look at this as a movie when everyone was still wearing the old uniforms and they were suddenly doing these widescreen shots that wouldn't be for television. So
well, also, before the television show, it was going to be a movie. Mm-hmm. There was development for a film as early as...
75,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the prospect of new Star Trek had existed for several years, and they just didn't exactly know what to do with it.
Well, I think they made the right choice.
See, Kirk is here... You know, if I can just get to warp speed, if I could just get this ship under my control, everything will be the way that it should be.
Right.
But he has this journey in this film of coming to the conclusion that it's not about that at all. It's about connecting with people, and he's really not completed till Spock comes back. And he changes after that.
It's almost like it's a bit of an insecurity that he doesn't have until his team is complete.
Mm-hmm. And again, this wormhole sequence... That's now starting with incredible effects that supervised by Doug Trumbull. Again, it's like it was probably there because somebody wanted to show what some of the mishaps of warp travel could be. But it plays into this whole theme because you see illustrated here the essential problem is these people are literally out of sync with each other.
And this wormhole actually was done by Dykstra's people.
Oh,
because
I'm sorry.
It was a scanning laser that they put on the motion control rig and stretched it out through time exposure. But it's still
But these effects
amazing.
On the bridge too?
No, these effects on the bridge were done by the effects animation crew and
the Robert Swarth?
Yes.
Okay. And if I remember correctly, they also had to shoot 35mm and 65mm
right.
on a lot of these angles. It was weeks and weeks and weeks. That in the 60s, they probably would have made 10 episodes of Star Trek.
Sure.
If I'm correct, this was the first sequence that was really completed, too.
That's correct.
For the effects.
It was in a very early promo reel.
Yeah, short of some minor editing during the sequence, this is just really was brilliant.
Another,
there was no changes that we needed.
Another area where the sound work was fantastic.
Right.
People may not know that when you make a film, you cannot do your sound edit until the picture is locked. Well, when your picture is not locked until 2 weeks before you have to be in theaters, you have no time to do any sound work. So Jerry's score covered a lot of that shortfall originally, and in fact, his last recording session was on December the 2nd of 79, 5 days before this thing was in theaters.
Yeah.
And if you go back and listen to, or watch and listen to the original version of the film, you will hear that the bridge of the Enterprise is pretty much dead. They may be stuck in some room tone to cover
and made of wood.
Edits. Yes, and everything was designed, but there was no. The sound editors would wait until the picture's locked and say, "Okay, go ahead now, do your sound." No
Chuck,
time.
Chuck had had played for us over and over again these audio beds that they had created for the film, for all different scenes. This whole effects, sound effect sequences that just never made it into the dub for time.
We replaced the explosion of the asteroid in the end of this sequence, and
it was such an anticlimax.
Well, it never made sense
because they basically cut to a stock shot of
right.
an explosion, and no one realized what was going on. And it was a last minute fix that they did.
Now there was one elimination that we did need. Very funny story. The original version following the explosion was a shot of Persis Kambata as Ilia in her navigator's station. Bouncing as the Enterprise is bounced.
Kind of
and let's say
now.
Certain parts of her anatomy
were bouncing more than
were
others.
More distracting.
Right. So when we show this scene to Doug Trumbull, he says, she's bouncing too much. And I said, well, we're taking that out. And he says, oh, you're taking out the bounce? I said, no, we're taking out the shot. He says, okay, good. But that
it
was
didn't
that
match
was
with
that
the rest
was,
of the rest of the shot. You know, she was bouncing, but
the shot was cut again because they had no effect. So how are you going to show? You know, but now the scene as it was finished. I mean, to me, it's harrowing. It's just harrowing to find to watch.
A good point to make is the removal of the obvious statements at this point.
Right.
Where
again, you know, people would say we're out of it, or the shields
new,
held.
The new screens held.
Right, but because they filmed those lines because. If they didn't come up with an effect that would show us that, somebody had to make it clear to the audience.
It became really interesting to have 20 years of knowledge and memory of the film, yet having to go back and still look at it from the perspective of we're telling the story and not get caught in the familiarity of what we've seen.
Dozens of HBO viewings went out the window the day that we brought a print to the Directors Guild, the big theater at the Directors Guild, and watched it and was like, wow.
And they were really kind to screen it two times for us with Bob.
That's right. In fact, the second time we brought the entire crew from Foundation Imaging down and
on
said...
On the 20th anniversary.
It was actually on December 7th, 1999.
We and celebrated with making an event for Bob. He didn't know about it. We actually...
We had actually hoped to originally have this done for that date. Do you remember that?
I do.
But, you know, Paramount, I mean, at least they eventually said okay and gave us the green light. It took a while to get to that point because my initial conversations with Bob Wise about this was right after George Lucas did his famous changes to the Star Wars trilogy in early 97. And then there was a lot of talk at that time about other films that were supposedly unfinished. There was never a better argument for that than this picture.
Speaking of the of how our goal was for having this completed for the 10th anniversary.
20th
anniversary, of course. The goal was for a theatrical re-release of the film. And when we went to the studio, there was a question of what we could do with this. And in the end, our goal was always for theatrical presentation, but we were given an opportunity to do it for DVD. The entire project was designed, planned, still is ready for being completed in the high-res, high-def, and theatrical format, so that this version, which Bob has now proclaimed is his final version of the film, is to stand the test of time, should be in its highest resolution for high-def or otherwise. The point is that with the 30th anniversary coming out, it's a new goal of mine to see if
we can. Well, we definitely need to get back and do it. It
right.
should be done. I think Paramount has to realize that it needs to be done. We're just waiting to see when that opportunity will present itself.
Yeah, we've had on and off, you know, communications with them about it, but with the 30th anniversary coming out, that's when I'd like to see it ready in time for.